Good morning. May it please the court, Christopher Live for appellants Andrew Grego and Maria Dworshak, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This case arises from the district court's conclusion that the record demonstrated no issues of material fact regarding the injury or causation elements of appellants' Washington Consumer Protection Act and negligence claims based on the Chapter 60.44 RCW medical services liens recorded against their personal injury settlements. But neither the record nor applicable Washington law supports these conclusions. First, regarding the injury element, the only standard that's been applied by the parties and the district court has been the CPA standard for injury, which recognizes that both quantifiable monetary damages and unquantifiable damages are sufficient to support a claim.
Is there any evidence in the record of unquantifiable damages in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. For one, there's the adverse consequences of having a medical lien recorded against you without an accompanying recorded lien release.
Is there any evidence in the record that either of the plaintiffs in this case had that happen to them?
There's no evidence that they've experienced these negative effects, but we've cited in our reply brief, I believe it was the reply, the Marotti case from the Washington Court of Appeals, which holds that even a potential harm is sufficient to support a CPA claim. And it's actually very similar to what happened in the Marotti case. It involved a judgment that was entered pursuant to a covenant not to execute, and the argument on appeal was that there was no harm that was sufficient to support a CPA claim because the underlying defendants were insulated from the effects of the judgment.
But in this case, Cadillac and Cardin had a right to some amount of lien, right? I mean, so the only injury would have been that there was an incorrect amount, not because of the fact of the lien.
Well, under these facts, Your Honor, we would disagree. For one, I believe Your Honor may be addressing the Blair case, which has been cited by Appleby's, which involved a deed of trust. And the court in that case held that the claimed error was a failure to provide sufficient proof that the beneficiary initiating the foreclosure was the proper beneficiary. The court said that there was no causation in that case flowing from the statutory violation. But unlike this case, we're not dealing with some technical deficiency. We're dealing with an instrument that we allege is invalid from the start.
Why is it invalid from the start?
Well, it wasn't signed by the claimant.
It was signed by their agent.
Well, there's nothing in Chapter 60.44 RCW that
offers. Why does there have to be something specific in the statute? Isn't that basic law?
Well, it's also a principle of Washington statutory construction that when the legislature expressly grants a type of authority in one statute but doesn't do so in another statute that didn't intend to grant that
authority. You're talking about the mechanics lien case?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is that the case?
Correct, Your Honor. And in the mechanics lien statutes, those statutes do expressly grant the authority for a third-party agent to sign a lien. The statute expressly states the claimant or another person authorized to act on his or her behalf can sign. That language is not present in the medical lien statutes. So it's a matter of either applying the canon of strict construction.
Don't we interpret these liens, though, somewhat favorably to the claimant here?
We don't, Your Honor, because there's no express canon of liberal construction or express mandate.
Well, it seems like the legislature was trying to assist them in trying to collect the debts that are owed to them for medical services rendered in a traumatic situation. Correct?
There was
nobody disputes that there's a debt owed to the hospital for the services provided. Isn't that correct?
And that's correct, Your Honor, but it's a more nuanced
point. Do you dispute that that the clients here received proper medical care from the hospital and incurred a debt?
They did receive medical care.
And the legislature has said the hospitals and other medical providers who provide care in this kind of situation can record a lien against any recovery from third-party tortfeasors and their insurers.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's what they did here. They filed a lien against the recovery.
It was a lien that failed to comply with the statutory requirements for having
Let's just assume that an agent can file the lien. Otherwise, then it would be proper, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So let's assume that the lien was proper. Where does that get? How does that affect your argument?
We believe it has no effect, if nothing else, because the amounts that were being demanded as payment also exceeded the statutory cap.
Now, did the hospital and Carden? I think it Cadillac was the hospital, right?
Correct.
And Carden was the agent.
Correct.
Did they know at the time they recorded the liens, did they know the amount of the settlements?
They did not know that.
Were they ever informed of the amount of the settlements?
They were informed in Mrs. Dorshuk's case. There was a letter that was sent by her personal injury attorney to Cardon that specifically stated you are exceeding the statutory cap on lien recoveries. Here's the correct amount. Please reduce the amount of the lien. And the response from Appleys was that Cadillac had denied that request. And that was followed with another demand letter for the excessive amount. The excessive amount was a little over $8,000. The proper amount was about $6,225, I believe. But that was followed by a subsequent.
So the only way, in your view, they could act properly under the medical lien statute is to demand payment of the exact amount of the lien that would be recoverable from the settlement.
Correct, Your Honor.
So in other words, in the other situation of what was the other fellow's name?
Andrew Grego, Your Honor.
Grego. They didn't know, so. They didn't know the amount, so what are they supposed to do?
Well, some of the arguments that were advanced before the district court, and it's in the record, it's primarily in Cardon's motion for judgment on the pleadings, is that this has been framed by Appleys that medical services liens really only concern the provider and the tortfeasor and their insurer. In their view, the patient and their personal injury attorney is essentially a bystander that has no standing or no...
But the lien is on the recovery, on the amount.
Correct, Your Honor.
The amount of the settlement.
Correct.
So what is a lawyer supposed to do in that situation?
In that situation,
He gets... Like in this case, from one of the insurance companies, he got $250,000?
Correct.
And he knew there was a lien out there.
And
so what is he supposed to do?
In this case, the personal injury...
Generally speaking, under the ethics of the Washington State Bar.
Well, RPC 1.15AG requires the attorney, when there's a good faith dispute over disposition of a portion of the fines, to withhold those fines until the dispute's resolved.
And that's what... Breckel, is that his name? That's what he did here, correct?
Correct.
That's what he did here.
Correct, Your Honor.
And you claim that was improper?
We claim that it was improper because it was induced by an invalid instrument, first of all.
How come you didn't sue him if it was improper?
Because the ultimate cause of the withholding was the improper... lien, both the fact that the lien was invalid in and of itself and the fact that the amounts withheld were excessive.
Now, there was another $50,000 for Greco, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that came from underinsured motorist protection?
Correct.
And was that under the lien statute, was that subject to the lien, to a medical lien?
No, and that was admitted in the record by one of Cardon's representatives, I believe their 30B6 witness. But the total amount that was demanded as payment for for Mr. Grego's lien necessarily encompassed.
So as I understand, following up on Judge Bichon's question, as I understand the injury, your strongest argument is that your clients were deprived of the use of the excess amount over the lien limitation, the limit on the lien.
Right? Our position is that's not our strongest argument for injury, but certainly one of the injuries that was incurred. The other injuries that were incurred were the loss of use of the total amount of the fines, which we contend was caused
by... Why would the hospital... I mean, if there was a proper lien that was filed and the lawyer did what he was supposed to do, how could they be the cause of that?
Well, our contention is the lien wasn't proper, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, if you assume that the lien is proper.
If we assume the lien was proper, then there would be no unfair or deceptive act in this case. But that's only assuming that the lien was proper.
So if the lien was proper, that is, if the agent could properly file the lien, it's your position that there's no deceptive practice afoot here?
Other than demanding the excess amounts, because that's clearly precluded by RCW 60.44.010 and its statutory cap, mm-hmm. as well as the fact that these liens don't apply at all to UIM proceeds.
Is there anything in the record that explains the thinking that the lawyer followed in deciding what to hold back?
There's nothing expressed, but we're entitled to reasonable inferences on summary judgment, and we can infer from the amounts that were withheld that there was a causal connection between the liens and the demand letters and those amounts being withheld. The amount withheld for Mr. Grego was exactly 25% of his combined total settlement amounts. The amount withheld from Mrs. Dorschach was the exact amount that was demanded as payment by appellees. So we can infer the causal connection solely through the amounts that were withheld.
So in the Grego matter, though, he it looks like what he withheld also included the $50,000 underinsured motor settlement amount as well.
Correct, Your Honor.
But that was the attorney's mistake. It wasn't due to anything that either Cadillac or Carden did, right?
Well, there was the demand letter that was sent by Cadillac and Carden saying that they wanted to recover a little over $79,000, which necessarily would encompass part of the tortfeasor settlement as well as the UIM settlement. But for that demand, which was not...
No evidence they knew what the settlement amount was. Right?
Well, there's also evidence in the record, Your Honor, that one of the reasons that Cadillac hired Cardon was to continually communicate with the tortfeasor and their insurers. They are attempting to shift the blame for their deficient collection practices, including communicating with the tortfeasor and their insurer, to the personal injury attorney in this case.
Counsel, I think you should answer any judge's question fully, and I'll give you extra time if you need to. But I noticed that your time left is only a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You wanted about 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor.
We'll add an extra minute on that.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ralph Palumbo. I represent Carden Healthcare. I'm going to share this argument with Brad Fisher, who represents Cadillac, the hospital. I'm going to discuss Carden's authority to sign the liens as Cadillac's authorized agent, the undisputed fact that appellants did not pay any money or incur any expense in response to Carden's alleged excessive demands, and Cadillac's right to seek payment from the tortfeasor rather than bill Medicare, Medicaid, and Mr. Fisher is going to cover appellant's loss of use caused by their own personal attorney, lawyer, that appellants have no ongoing liability to the hospital and that appellants have failed to state any CPA claim. First, let me talk about the Cadillac's authority. RCW 60.44 entitles Cadillac to file medical liens against tortfeasors who injured the appellants and the tortfeasors' insurance companies. Appellants contend that otherwise valid liens are invalid by the fact that Cadillac, a corporation that can act only through its agents, did not literally sign the notice of lien. Appellants rely on a rule of strict compliance stated in the Williams v. Athletic Field case, but in Williams, the Washington Supreme Court held that the lien statute should be liberally applied to a claimant such as Cadillac, who is intended to be protected by the statute and provided lienable services. Appellant's reply brief exposes the fallacy of their own argument because appellants say that RCW 6044010 provides, quote, the exclusive list of individuals and entities authorized to claim a medical services lien, including every operator of a hospital. And then in the next breath, appellants say, thus, under RCW 6044010, medical services must be subscribed by the claimant or its employees. Well, a Cadillac employee is not the operator of the hospital. A Cadillac employee can only pursue a lien if they are authorized by the hospital to do so. Thus, neither the language of 6044 nor any reasonable interpretation of the statute supports the appellant's position that a lien notice signed by an authorized Cadillac employee is valid, but a lien notice authorized by or signed by Cadillac's authorized agent is not valid. Let me move on to the excess payments. Essentially, counsel has argued that Cardin made demands to pay more than 25% of their personal injury settlement.
Isn't that correct?
It is not correct, Your Honor. For Cardin filed two liens. The initial lien was for the full amount of the Cadillac bill because Cardin had no idea whether there ever would be a settlement.
Can you focus on Doroshuk for your purpose of your argument?
Sure.
Because the other one, we know that Cardin and Cadillac didn't know the amount of the settlement.
Right.
And I understand that. But for Doroshuk, they seemed the correspondence between the lawyer and your client shows that they knew that the settlement was for $25,000.
Right. And it is correct, Your Honor, that Cardin erroneously sent a letter citing the full amount of the Cadillac bill in Ms. Dorchuk's case was $8,550 instead of 25% of her recovery, which was $6,250. The Brecky firm responded to that letter with a letter stating that $8,550 exceeds the 25% cap in 6044 and requesting that Cadillac accept $6,250. That's ER 247. So clearly, the Brecky firm knew what the limitation was, and they simply could have paid that amount, and it would have extinguished the lien.
But let me ask you: couldn't the hospital still demand their payment of the full? They weren't willing. Looked like they weren't willing to compromise the amount of the bill. They're demanding full payment out of the settlement funds.
That's right.
I mean, they have the right to do that, correct?
Yeah, they do. But there's no evidence.
But if you're going to base your recovery on the amount of this lien, then you're stuck, at least for that purpose of the lien. You're stuck with the 62,
Right, and what we point out is that the evidence in the record in both cases show that the Brecky firm was well aware of the 25% limitation in the cap. The liens would have been extinguished had Brecky done nothing.
He also knew that the hospital wasn't willing to compromise for that amount on the total amount of the debt, which the client is still obligated. Isn't it correct, as I said at the outset, that the true debt is the amount of the bill that the hospital charged her for, correct?
Right. But the Brecky created the problem. He could have simply discharged the lien or pay the $6,250, and that would have discharged the lien. He required no permission from the hospital to do that. And indeed, had he done nothing in the first place, the insurance company for Ms. Doroshuk would have paid the $6,250 and that would have discharged the lien. But even with all of that, Ms. Doroshuk never paid one dime on her bills. And so even if you conclude that Cardin made an excessive demand, there still is no injury because Mr. Dorchek never paid her Cadillac medical bills, not one penny of it, and never incurred any expense in connection with that.
Didn't she lose the use of the overage, the whatever it is, $2,300, while the incorrect amount of the lien was being held up?
There's no evidence in the record to tell us whether, in Mr. Grego's case, we know that the Brecke firm calculated an amount and put it in trust for a period of time. Mr. Fisher is going to address that. In Ms. Dorchuk's case, there's no evidence whatsoever about whether or not the Brecke firm withheld any of Ms. Dorchuk's funds. And Ms. Dorchuk testified she didn't even know about the lien until the day of her deposition. So there's no evidence in this record, Your Honor, from which you could draw an inference that Ms. Dorchuk was harmed by this a single erroneous letter which referenced the full amount of the lien. And moreover, as Mr. Fisher will explain, the hospital has walked away from this. They're not asking that any money be paid, and the time to sue the tortfeasor has expired, so we couldn't now sue the tortfeasor and force Mr. Grego or Mr. Dorchuk to make good on the hold harmless and indemnification agreement they signed on behalf of the tortfeasor. I'll address the UIM quickly. Uninsured motorist, there's one letter which shows, or one note from Cardin which shows that Cardin collected information on uninsured motorist policies. There's no evidence in the record that Cardin or Cadillac ever demanded any portion of that. And in fact, the record proves that Cardin never even knew the amount of Ms. Dorchuk's UIM insurance. And again, because Ms. Dorchuk hasn't paid anything or incurred any expense, there's no damage. And I want to take this opportunity to turn this over to Mr. Fisher, unless Your Honors have additional questions for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Brad Fisher on behalf of Cadillac Regional Medical Center. As Mr. Palumbo alluded, I'll be trying to speak to the causation and damage pieces of this case, and those are obviously issues which Judge Peterson felt were dispositive here, such that she didn't even need to reach some of these arguments about liability. If we take a small step back here, and things work the way that even these folks say they were intended to work, right, by Congress and the Washington legislature, Cadillac should have been paid a little under $70,000 on the liens against the proceeds that were received by these two plaintiffs. Instead, Cadillac has received nothing. It's not going to receive anything at this point. It's too late to make a claim against the government payors. The liens have expired. They have no recourse here. But putting aside the inequity of that, there's three reasons why there's no claim here based on causation and damages. Even if there was a defect in the form of the lien notices that were filed, and to be very clear, as Mr. Palumbo alluded, it is our adamant position there is not, that an authorized agent may execute a document on behalf of its principal. But even if there was, which other than this Dorchuk snafu, plaintiff's counsel is saying is the basis for this entire case. Even if there was a defect in the form, it is not a defect in the form of the lien that caused the damages that the plaintiffs are seeking here. Okay? It's the fact that there is a right to a medical lien. That's what they're objecting to here. There's no causation.
In other words, so I understand what you're saying is that the hospital had the right to file a lien or record a lien for the amount of the debt, and they did that.
Exactly, Your Honor. And we might have a different
case. No, whatever the settlement might ultimately be.
Yeah, because as you've alluded to in your question today, you don't know, right, on the front end. And in fact, you can't know because you have to file it before the settlement is paid. So almost right. By definition, you're going to have a gap there of the knowledge. We might have a different case here if we made a mistake on the amount. Okay? They'd be saying, well, you misstated the amount. Spot on, to the dollar, we hit the amount of the liens, okay? They didn't talk about the Blair case in their reply brief, even though that's a prominent part of our opposition on this appeal. And what the Blair case said, that's a Washington Court of Appeals case from 2016, where the court found there was a violation of the Deed of Trust Act by the trustee. Okay? The trustee did not conform to the law. But what the court held is there was no causation of damages because even if the trustee had done it right, the plaintiff would have incurred the same expenses. Okay, that's this case. If someone else, I don't know, a W-2 employee versus an authorized agent had executed the lien notice, which they say is fine, we would be exactly where we are today. So there was no causation. Second of all, the decision to hold money in trust here by Mr. Brecky, who's a very experienced personal injury attorney, was a decision that he made potentially along with his clients.
Well, but the only reason, isn't it correct, though, that as a lawyer in that his situation, the only reason why he would have done that is because a lien had been recorded and there was efforts to collect on the liens?
Potentially, Your Honor, but what's clear in the record here is when Mr. Grego asked for his money, he paid him.
Well, that's a separate. I don't know what the ethics are of how Mr. Brecky proceeded, but it seems like if a lawyer is holding money and there are conflicting claims on that money, then the lawyer has to act, you know, has to act responsibly.
And Your Honor,
so you know, it may be that he never would have. He will maybe only would have held that money just overnight, long enough to write a check. You know, get it in his bank account and then write a check for the full amount of the settlement, less his fees and costs to his clients.
Yeah,
but he couldn't do that because, well, I don't know. I don't want to pretend that I know the ethics of the Washington State Bar, but once he was aware that there was a conflicting demand on portion of that settlement money, it seems like he's got to be careful.
Well, just to be clear, I mean, we don't believe there's any violation of rule, you know, of RPC 1.15AG here in this case. There's no, this is their lawyer, right? Just go get a declaration that says what happened and why, if you want to put in proof of the causation and the reasoning for that. What we know is he did not hold the money until the, quote, dispute was resolved. He unilaterally decided to release Mr. Grego's money when he asked for it. And what he took was an indemnity for himself to protect himself. He did not hold the money under 1.15G, and you can't infer that given what his conduct actually was in this case. They could have obtained a declaration from him or deposition testimony. They did not do that here. And so we just have this vacuum that we've stepped into here. That does not meet their burden. If they wanted to, the insurers could have paid the liens, right? Notices were proper. They knew about them. They were duly on notice. What these folks decided to do is take the money, right? Brecky collects his third on all of the money, and then wait it out, right? And it worked here. They got away with it because the liens expired, and we can't get any of the money now. That's what happened here. But it was.
Hey, I'm not sure. Let me. I just want to make sure I understand that statement. So, if the liens didn't exist, you would have been. If the opportunity to collect on a lien didn't exist, you'd be able to collect through Medicaid or Medicare.
A small fraction, probably less than the cost. But yes, we could have submitted a claim.
Does that when the hospital does that, does that require them to waive the balance of any amount that was not paid?
It generally speaking, I think there are exceptions, but I think the answer is generally speaking, yes. Which is why this notion that the excess, you were asking questions about Ms. Doroshuk, and I know I only have about 40 seconds
left,
is that Ms. Doroshuk, you know, we asked for $8,500. Under their theory, they should have written us a check for $6,250. We never got it. We're never going to get it. She hasn't been harmed. But the gap there, the difference, we cannot recover from her. Okay, you were asking, is this debt still out there? Is this,
yes.
First of all, the lien notice is just the lien notice, and we can only recover what the statute allows. That's what that exchange of the letters and the lien was about, and they can close out the lien by paying it, and under, I think it's 060, they can demand a release from us, right? If they pay 25%, they don't need permission. You just pay it, mm-hmm. And you are entitled to demand a release. That's what should have happened.
A release of the lien.
Yes, exactly.
So if the 25% is paid, and that leaves, you know, a balance of the underlying medical debt, Then what happens?
Well, that would be a function, Your Honor, of what the payer structure is in this case, okay? If they had no insurance, if they were self-pay, okay, theoretically they would owe the balance for the services, right? Part of it was recovered from the tortfeasor. They would be carrying a balance. If they have a government payor or theoretically, you know, a commercial payor under a contract with Regents, there would be limits on what the recovery would be, both what the reimbursement would be to my client and what we could recover against the patient who was a beneficiary under that particular plan. And the fact here is, and again, we've got a huge vacuum here, but the fact is we can't collect. We can collect on a lien. The government, the legislature gave us that right, to allude to your comments, because they thought it was important that people treat traumatically injured people. We have that right to the extent of that right. We cannot go after an insured patient for a balance or anything else in a manner that's inconsistent with the contract. Okay, and that didn't happen here. So this dispute, I would submit at the end of the day, this discrepancy with the letters, again, to Mr. Palumbo's comment, they had it within their power to make the payment and extinguish the lien. They didn't do that. Our lien expired, and we're out. So Cadillac's getting nothing. Even though it had lien rights of, by their math, about $70,000, Cadillac is ultimately not going to get paid anything.
I mean, I just have one last question. I don't want to take any more time, but I just want to understand this process, because sometimes you encounter cases that you just don't, you know, it's kind of a unique area of the law. One does not know all the intricacies, but so the lien is only good for 1 year, is that correct?
Correct.
And can the hospital attempt to enforce the lien through some sort of action within that 1 year period?
Yes, I believe under the statute it specifically would be an action against the tortfeasor or its insurer. So you have a right to execute on the lien for 1 year against the tortfeasor or its insurer. It is not a right against the patient, strictly speaking. What happened here is...
Why doesn't the hospital, like in this case, why didn't they just file a lawsuit against the insured? The insurer.
Yes, but really by the time we knew, certainly in the case of Grigo, it was too late, right? It expired. We didn't know it had been paid. We wrote a letter to the insurer and said, we're filing a new lien. They said, sorry, we paid that last April. Okay, so we didn't even have the right to do that. But the way this would have worked in substance, Your Honor, is if we had done that, the insurer then would have enforced its indemnity right against the patient, right? Because that was the condition upon which they received the payment around the lien, was that they would indemnify the tortfeasor against the claim by us, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So where you get to at the end of the day is... They can end up, if we can make a timely claim against the tortfeasor, they have to end up indemnifying the tortfeasor, and the 25% comes back to us, and that circuitous route. We lost the right to do that here.
Okay.
So, again, technical defects don't create causation if the injuries would have occurred anyways. These folks, at the end of the day here, they made out great. We're not getting anything. We didn't cause any injury to them within the meaning of the Washington Consumer Protection Act. Thank you.
Fred, your time's up, but you can finish your sentence if you need to.
Consumer Protection Act. Was that my last three words? I think those are my last three words, so thanks. I'm finished. Thank you, Your Honor.
Briefly, Your Honors. There's the representation that there's no evidence in the record that the 25% or excess of 25% for Mrs. Dorshak was held in trust. That's incorrect. That's contained at ER 258, which is an account statement from the Brecky firm, which it states expressly $8,555 held in trust. It also mentions Cadillac on that line item. So the evidence is in the record. Mr. Fisher addressed the Blair case, which I addressed in my opening argument. And this case does not fall within the facts of Blair. The statutory defect in that case was failure of a trustee to obtain sufficient proof of the proper beneficiary before initiating a foreclosure action There is no question in Blair as to whether the deed of trust was invalid or any other mortgage instrument was invalid. In this case, that is the question squarely before the court, whether this instrument, which created a secured interest in the patient's settlements, was invalid or not. So this is distinguishable from Blair. There's also the suggestion that, again, that all causation falls on the personal injury attorney, that was his mistake. And one of your honors raised this point, it was within Appley's power to, one, request information from the tortfeasor and their insurer, and two, to act within that one-year period by filing a lawsuit attempting to enforce their lien rights or preserve them. That didn't occur in this case. And finally, on the question of whether there's a debt in this case, there are the outstanding charges. I'm still not sure that I've heard that Cadillac has said that they're not going to pursue those charges through some other means in addition to the lien, regardless of the result of this lawsuit. Our position is that those outstanding charges appear to still be out there. There was a bill issued to Mr. Gregoil, and there was the opportunity for Medicare and Medicaid to pay those, but for pursuing these liens that were invalid. And that is an expense that has been incurred. The Frias case held that there were fees that were charged against the appellant in that case that had not been paid, but remittance of payments aren't required, and that should they prevail on their CPA claim, that plaintiff was entitled to have those fees struck. If these outstanding charges are still at issue, that's part of the relief we're seeking in this case, to have any charges struck or otherwise declared non-collectible from appellants. And I see my time's up, Your Honors.
Thank you for the argument.
Thank you.
Thank all counsel for their excellent arguments. And the Grego case shall be submitted.